Thank you very much. I wanted to call the Vector Institute the Parameter Institute, but people said that might be confusing, so I didn't. Okay, today I'm going to talk about an idea about how to build a visual system that's much more like the human system than current computer vision systems. It incorporates three new ideas in machine learning that I'll explain as I go along. One is transformers, that's mainly used in big language models. Another is unsupervised learning of visual representations. So learning how to represent things in an image without being given any labels about what they should be called. And the third one is generative models of images that use neural fields. And I'll explain that when I get to it. I'm going to combine all three in a system that I call GLOM. At present, it's only an imaginary system. We've only simulated little bits of it. And the idea is it's going to be much more like human perception. So really, the people working on new neural networks have two goals. One is engineering, and all the people working on neural networks applied to physics are doing engineering. They're doing science indirectly. They're engineering the neural network so the neural networks can do science. There's a different approach to neural networks, which is trying to understand how the brain works. So trying to understand real neural networks. And that's my main interest. I haven't been that successful in that. I've been more successful in engineering as a sort of side effect of trying to understand how the brain works. But I still think the brain has a lot to teach us. And for half a century, the only reason for believing that great big neural networks with not much innate knowledge would be able to learn complicated things was that the brain does it. So if you want to know how the brain does vision, there's many sources of information. There's psychological demonstrations of how our visual system goes wrong. There's weird effects of brain damage, which I don't have time to go into. There's the anatomy of the neocortex, which is the bit of the brain that does vision. There's how cortical neurons respond to stimuli. There's the properties of synapses, which are how the connection strengths between neurons are stored and modified. And finally, there's engineering. There's computer simulations that show which theories work and which ones don't. But my view is if you want to understand how the brain works, you better use all the sources of information you can get your hands on. And today I'm going to focus on a particular problem, which doesn't worry people doing engineering, but it worries people trying to understand how the brain works, which is each image you look at will have a different pars tree. That is a different composition in terms of wholes and parts. And real neural networks can't dynamically allocate neurons. That is, in a computer, you have some memory and you put anything you like in the memory and you put some pointers to other things. And now I can represent some arbitrary graph structure very easily on a conventional computer by using the fact that I can put in pointers and the address bus can find the things that's at the other end of those pointers. But a brain isn't like that. A brain has neurons, and what the neurons do depends on the weights of the neurons. And the weights don't change rapidly. At least they don't completely change rapidly. So you can't just take a bunch of neurons and say, okay, for the next 100 milliseconds, you stand for this. It doesn't work like that. We've got a static neural net and it needs to represent a pars tree that's different for every image. So how's it going to do that? In symbolic AI, you just set aside some memory and you can create nodes and a graph, and that's easy. About 5 years ago, I had a theory called capsules that said, well, since you can't dynamically allocate hardware, you better allocate it in advance. Because I still bought into the idea that if you know about some fragment of a shape like a nose, you better have the knowledge of a nose in one place. So you better have a bunch of neurons that know about noses. Maybe you have a few copies of them. And the idea was you would have a bunch of neurons that know about noses. Most of the time they'd be inactive, but you could activate that bunch of neurons. And once you'd activated a few of these groups of neurons called capsules, you would then wire them together by using connections that were gated. So you'd activate the gates on some of the connections and you could dynamically wire it up to represent a pars tree. I no longer believe that theory, even though we got it to work. What I believe in now is the idea that you're going to allocate neurons, not types of thing, but you're going to allocate them to little patches of the image. And so we're going to take the hardware we've got for doing vision, and we're going to allocate it to columns. And each column is going to represent what's going on in a small patch of the image, but it's going to have a multi-level representation of what's going on in that patch. So a vector that represents something, I'll call an embedding, and a single patch, the column for a single patch, might have an embedding that represents a nostril, an embedding that represents a nose, an embedding for a face, an embedding for a person, an embedding for a party. So that will be a multi-level representation of what's happening in that part of the image. The lowest level embedding in that hierarchy might be produced by something like a convolutional neural net. But how the hierarchy then works is what this talk's about. And the way we're going to represent a parse tree is simply by using islands of agreement to represent the nodes in the parse tree. So the thing that's going to be dynamic is the vector embeddings that we have at each location. And they're in neural activities, so they can be changed quickly. And the way we represent the parse tree is not by putting in nodes connected by pointers, at least not directly. We represent it by islands of agreement. So here's a picture of that. This is showing you six columns for nearby locations in the image. At the bottom level, you can see all of the contents of the image patches are represented by different vectors. These vectors would probably have thousands of dimensions, in the brain maybe tens of thousands. I'm just representing them by 2D vectors just so that I can show agreement. If you look at the top level, this is an iterative neural net. It's just been shown an image. It hasn't yet had time to settle on a representation of the scene, of the whole scene, but it has settled on a representation of what's going on at the object level in these six image patches, and they're all occupied by the same object. Let's suppose that's a face. So that black vector that agrees for all six locations will be a representation of the fact that it's a face, whose face it is, what the expression is, and what the pose of the face is. That is, the coordinate transform between the intrinsic frame of reference of the face and the intrinsic frame of reference of the camera or retina. That's what I'll call pose. And all of those things will be in that vector. And the vector will be identical, if GLOM worked nicely, in all six locations. At the next level down, the first three locations might be occupied by a nose, and the next three locations might be occupied by a mouth. And so all the locations occupied by the same nose would have identical vectors. So at the part level, they're identical. Of course, at the subpart level, at the level below, they're not all identical. And I think you can see now, if you look at the islands form a tree. Bigger islands contain smaller islands. You can make more complicated structures than trees this way, but trees is all I'm going to talk about for now. Now, if you're a physicist, a way to think about this is that each level here is like an icing model. At each level, you're trying to get agreement with neighbors, just like you do in an icing model. It differs from an icing model in that at each level, instead of having a spin that's either up or down, you have a real valued vector with thousands of dimensions. And so these much more complicated things are trying to agree. You're in a continuous space now, and that helps in some ways. It makes it hard to get trapped, stuck in local optima. With spins, you have to flip from up to down. With this, you can move continuously. The other thing that's different from an icing model, one of the other things different, is that we have multiple levels here. So if you look at the object level, for example, you've got things at the level above and things at the level below that are providing boundary conditions, or what I think you would call external fields. But these external fields are all very local. So each of these columns corresponds to a little patch of image. And in each column, the embedding at one level will get an external field from the vector above and an external field from the vector below. And those external fields will be set up in quite a complicated way. You'll take the vector above, you'll put it through a coordinate transform to get the external field on the level below, and similarly for the level below. So it's much more complicated than an icing model in terms of how the fields at different levels interact, but it's in the spirit of icing models. Before I go into the details of the model, I want to convince you of some interesting facts about human perception. So we're going to do some psychology now, and I'm going to give you a demonstration. It's a demonstration I cooked up about 42 years ago, and it's intended to show that people really do use rectangular coordinate frames. It's not just Descartes that used rectangular coordinate frames. People do it. And what's more, they really do parse images. So we're going to do a little task. And it works much better if you do it. And because this is a Zoom meeting, other people can't see you getting it wrong. So I want you to imagine a wireframe cube resting on a tabletop in front of you. And it's about 1 foot along a side. It's made of matte black wires. And from your point of view, there's a front bottom right-hand corner, and there's a top back left-hand corner, front bottom right, top back left. And you put your fingertips on those two corners. And now keeping the bottom fingertip fixed so that that corner stays on the tabletop, you're going to rotate the cube so that that body diagonal between your fingers becomes vertical. So there it is, it's now vertical. Okay, now take the finger that's at the bottom and point to where the other corners of the cube are and do it quickly. Okay. It's tricky, right? Now you guys are physicists, so you're probably better than average at spatial intelligence. But most people point out four other corners. And then they're very surprised when you say there's six other corners. I'll show you where the corners are in a minute. But what most people point out, they have their fingers like this, and they point out one, two, three, four. And what they pointed out is two square base pyramids stuck base to base. That's called an octahedron. All the faces are triangles. It's an octahedron. And it has an interesting relation to a cube. It's got exactly the same symmetries as a cube if you replace corners by faces and faces by corners. So this strongly suggests that your most fundamental knowledge about a cube, that you get from a cube in its normal orientation, is its symmetries. It's got these two bilateral symmetries, or fourfold rotational symmetry. And you preserve that when all else fails and you have no idea where the corners are, you stick with the symmetry you know about. Now, of course, if you look at the name of a cube, it's got a three in it. And in this new orientation I've given you, a cube has a completely different set of symmetries. I mean, it always has the same symmetries, but a completely different set of symmetries is obvious. So there are the six corners with the edges connecting them that you were meant to point out. You can think of it as three flaps, a green flap, a blue flap, and a red flap that slope upwards and outwards. And I'll call that the crown. And that's one way of understanding that arrangement of six rods. Your top finger is connected to the vertices of those flaps, and your bottom finger is connected to the other three corners, and that makes a cube. Notice one other thing, that when you say see it like this as a crown, you're completely unaware of the right angles. We're not interested in right angles, as psychologists believe. We're interested in things that align with the rectangular frame we're currently using. If things align with the rectangular frame we're currently using, we're exquisitely sensitive to whether they're right angles or not. If we use a different frame, like you're using now when you understand a cube as what I'll call a hexahedron, using that body diagonal of the normal cube as the main axis, then you understand completely different things about it, and right angles are kind of irrelevant. That's evidence that we're using rectangular coordinate systems. You can also see this a different way, like that, for example. The green flap's the same, but now you've got a flap sloping downwards and outwards, that red flap, and you've got a central rectangle, and you only have the two ends of the central rectangle. But when you see it like this, you're very well aware that A and D are parallel. And if you take this interpretation and close your eyes, you're aware that A and D are parallel, but you're not really aware of any other pairs of parallel edges. Because again, A and D line up with the rectangular coordinate system you're using for that central rectangle, but the other edges don't line up with any of the rectangular coordinate systems you're using. Okay, so what's happening here is the very same arrangement of rods can be understood in two different ways. And we do understand it in two different ways. It's not like the Necker cube. When it reverses, you think there's something different out there in the world. Here, when you understand it in two different ways, you don't think the world's changed, but you know different things about it. So they're clearly two different internal representations. And one thing to notice is that convolutional neural nets do not have this. Convolutional neural nets don't have completely different interpretations of the same input. So in that sense, they're very unlike human perception. We know they're also very unlike human perception in that you can make tiny changes to pixel intensities, and the convolutional net, if the changes are made in an adversarial way, will completely fail to recognize what's in the image, even though it's obvious to us. And that's the kind of thing I want to get rid of by making neural nets work more like people. So this might be a graph representing the crown interpretation of those six edges. And if you think about this graph, the whole object's a crown. Its major parts are these flaps. And on the arc between the whole and the part, I've written the relationship between the whole and the part, which could be represented by a matrix. The matrix would be the coordinate transform between the intrinsic frame of reference used for the crown and the intrinsic frame of reference used for the flap. Okay. The other interpretation would be similar in form, but would have different components and different relationships. There's one other thing I could represent in a graph like this, which is I could, let's take the crown again. I could add another kind of relationship, which is the relationship of the whole to the viewer. That's that RWV, the thing in the heavy blue box. And in fact, once I've added RWV, so if I know how the crown is related to the viewer, I can actually compute all the other things without even looking, because I can take RWV, I can multiply it by RWX, and I get the relationship of the flap to the viewer. And so I can propagate the relationship of everything to the viewer across this structural description, across this graph, if you fill in one of those heavy blue boxes. And notice these are two quite different types of relationship. They're both coordinate transforms. One's the coordinate transform between a whole and a part. Another's the coordinate transform between a whole or a part and the viewer. In that sense, they're similar, but they have very different roles in perception. The relationship between a whole and a part doesn't change when you change your viewpoint. It's a stable thing that's part of our knowledge of the shape. It changes if we deform the shape, but for a given shape, it's fixed. Whereas the knowledge about the relationship between the whole and the viewer changes as you change your viewpoint. So the things, when you change viewpoint, the things in heavy blue boxes are equivariant. They change as you change the viewpoint. And the things not in the heavy blue boxes, those relationships are invariant. They're part of your knowledge of what the crown shape is. And that strongly suggests that the things that are equivariant should be in neural activities, which change as you change viewpoint. And the things that are invariant should be in weights. Okay. So I'll come back to all that. This is a little aside about one of the other ingredients of this system, which is called contrastive self-supervised learning. And the idea is that you're going to try and learn to extract from images stuff that's invariant across the image, either across space or across time. And that's the stuff that's interesting. So all physicists know that. I mean, physics basically consists of finding things that are invariant. That's what an equation is. It says the two sides should be the same as each other. And the two sides should keep being the same as each other when you vary something. Like you stretch the spring and the two sides are still the same as each other. So we came up with a learning algorithm in 1992, which says you take two separate patches of an image and you put them both through the same neural net with the aim of getting out vectors that are the same. So different things go in and the same thing comes out. We were trying to use that for extracting things like surface orientation and surface depth. But much more recently, that idea has been used for extracting the identity of objects. And it works very well for that. So I'll explain in a bit more detail one version of this idea. It's a version developed at my Google lab in Toronto. By someone called Ting Chen and other people working with him. So here, what you do is you take an image X. You make two different versions of X by taking two different crops, which might overlap, but might not. They might be the same size, but they might not. You also mess with the color balance. The reason for messing with the color balance is so you can't cheat and use color histograms to say whether two things came from the same image. Now you take those two crops of the image, XI and XJ, you run each of them through a deep neural network, the same neural network represented by F dot, and you get representations of those crops, HI and HJ. And the question is, how do you learn those neural nets? Well, the way we're going to learn them is we're going to take those representations, We're going to project them down to a smaller vector, zi and zj. And then we're going to try and make the zi be the same as the zj. Now, if you just do that, if you just try and change all the weights in all the neural networks, so zi and zj end up the same when you put in two different crops from the same image, what will happen is zi and zj will just turn into constants, possibly zero. They'll just be the zero vector, whatever you show it. And they'll say, hey, we've got perfect agreement. But that's not really what you mean by agreement. You really mean significant correlation, and constants don't have correlations. So what you really mean by agreement is, if you put in two crops of the same image, zi and zj should be similar. If you put in two crops from different images, zi and zj should not be similar. If they're already different, that's fine. Leave them, don't touch them. But if they're similar when you put in crops from different images, you now make them more different. So you push apart zi and zj's that come from different images, and you pull together ones that come from the same image. That's more nicely balanced. And that leads to very good representations of what's going on in image patches. You can show they're good representations, because then what you do is you take those representations you've learned. You take a patch of an image, you take the representation of the patch, and now you put that into a classifier. You say, can you classify what the object is in this image? And if your images contain one obvious object or one large object, this does very well. It does just about as well as a classifier where all of the weights are trained by using the labels. And notice with this contrastive learning, you do almost all your learning before you ever see the label. And then once you've learned the representation, you just learn to associate that representation with a label, just using one layer of weights. And so that's just to show that it really did learn good representations. And then it turns out you can use these representations for all sorts of things. So that's SimClay. Now, one thing wrong with SimClay is that suppose you take an image that has several things going on in it, and suppose I take a crop that contains part of object A and part of object B, and another crop from the same image that contains part of object A and part of object C. Do I really want to get exactly the same representation for those two crops? And it's fairly obvious you don't. What you want is the bits of the crops that are of the same object maybe should have the same representation, but the bits of the crops that are different objects should have different representations. And the system I'm going to talk about, GLOM, is designed to overcome that by using attention. That is, you take these two crops, and GLOM decides which bits of which crops should be the same. Okay. So you can think of it as, suppose you have an image patch that contains a nose and you have an image patch that contains a mouth. Those are quite different things. But suppose I wanted to use exactly the same vector for representing both image patches. What do I have to do to get the same vector? Well, it's obvious what you have to do. You have to take the nose, you have to put it through the coordinate transform that transforms from the pose of the nose to the pose of the face, and then you'll get a predictive face vector that contains the nose. And you have to take the mouth and do the same thing, and then you get a predictive face vector that contains the mouth. And if this nose and mouth really belong together, they should be pretty much the same face vector. So by doing these coordinate transforms between two levels of the icing model, the multi-layered icing model, we make things that are very different in one layer, two very different islands, merge into the same island in the layer above. But of course, it's the same island at a different level of representation, at the object level rather than the part level. So one of the inspirations for this was biology. Biology is very wasteful. Every cell has all the DNA for making any kind of cell. So a brain cell knows how to be a liver cell. At least it would if it was put in the right environment and it was young enough. What's happening is the environment of a cell determines what proteins it actually expresses, but every cell has all the knowledge. And that vector of expressed proteins is like the vector of activities in a column. It's like the embedding vectors. And that's what makes cells different. And of course, within an organ, cells have similar vectors of protein expressions. Even though it seems wasteful to duplicate all the knowledge, it makes life much simpler. So biology does it. And so a cell is like a patch of the image and the column of hardware that goes with it. So think of a cell as like this column of hardware that's all devoted to representing what's going on in one patch of the image, in one location. And the complete vector of embeddings in that column is like the vector of protein expressions in a cell. And of course, within an organ, you get suborgans with slightly different vectors of protein expressions. So now, before I finally show you this model, I have a disclaimer. Vision is actually a sampling process. We think you look out there and you see the whole image, but you don't. You only see a very small part of it in high resolution. You're misled into thinking you can see it all at once. And you're misled because as soon as you ask yourself, can I see that? You look at it and you can see it. It's a sort of just-in-time perception. The outer loop of vision consists of deciding where to look so that you can get the information you need to do a task. I'm going to completely ignore that. The inner loop is after you've decided where to look, you process the information that's now on your retina with lots of fine detail near the fixation point and very little fine detail far away from it. And this talk is really about what happens on your first fixation. So you open a newspaper, look at a new image, you've no idea what it is, you fixate at one point on the image, and what happens now? And I'm just trying to model that in this talk. Okay, so here's what's going to be happening within a column. This is kind of an expansion of the interactions in the icing model. And remember, there's going to be two kinds of interactions. Within a level, different locations are going to interact, and I'm not showing you that here. And within a column, which is local to a particular patch of image, there's going to be interactions between the levels, and those are going to be quite complicated. And this diagram is about all the interactions going on within a column. So let's look at the rightmost level L. Let's suppose that's a nose. That's getting input bottom up from the previous time step. So this is an iterative net. The columns settle down, just like a icing model relaxing, but possibly not with a change in temperature as you go. So the level L gets bottom-up input from level L minus one, so from the nostril, but that has to come through a coordinate transform. So it's a neural net that needs a couple of hidden layers to do what we need it to do. I'll come into more detail what it needs to do later. It gets top-down input. Let's suppose there's a face that's still a bit confused, but thinks it's maybe a face at the level above. It's going to be providing top-down input, again, via coordinate transform, because you know the pose of the face relative to the image, and what you want is a pose of the nose relative to the image. So those are the two main inputs within a column. I've also got a green arrow, which is just temporal integration. If you were looking at a dynamic image, the green arrow might contain more dynamics to it, like Newton's second law or something. I guess it would need to look at the two previous things because it needs the velocity. Okay, so that's the interactions within a column. And in addition to those three interactions, the colored ones I showed you, there's a fourth kind of interaction, which is what you're used to in icing models, which is interactions with other nearby locations. Here, low-level things will look at fairly nearby locations. High-level things will look at much more distant locations, and they'll look at them with sparse connectivity. I'll come to that later. And the interactions with nearby locations are going to be attention-weighted. That is, in a normal icing model, some neighboring spin has a particular effect on you, if you're a spin, and you don't get to choose whether you attend to it or not. But we're going to modify that, and we're going to say at each column, you get to choose which other columns you attend to. So if you take the level L embedding in column X, I'll call that LX, and you take your scalar product with the level L embedding in column Y, call that LY, and then you exponentiate. If you've got a big scalar product, that'll give you a big number. If you've got a small scalar product, it'll give you a very small number by comparison. So a column X looks at the at level L, looks at the nearby columns, it takes these scalar products, it exponentiates them, it then normalizes. And that's how much attention it pays to these other columns. So other columns that already have similar embedding vectors, it'll pay a lot of attention to those. And now what it's going to do is it's going to take a weighted average of all four things. So we're taking a weighted average of the bottom-up contribution, the top-down contribution. So that's the external fields from the level above and the level below. You're doing some temporal integration, and you're taking into that weighted average, you're mixing what nearby columns believe at level L, but weighting it by whether they agree with you. So you ignore things that disagree with you. And as I say there, this creates echo chambers. We know this from social media, and they're bad things in social media, but they're great things for segmenting images. So the aim is to get echo chambers by only attending to things that agree with you. And so the aim is to end up with this thing you've already seen, islands of agreement. Now let's talk about some of the problems. First, the top-down problem. The top-down neural net has a real problem, which is, if you look at those black vectors, then they're all the same, right? At the object level, they're all the same. But at the part level, they have to produce different things. And this isn't just stochasticness. They have to, in a deterministic kind of a way, they have to produce red vectors in the location where the nose is and green vectors in the location where the mouth is. So how do you get exactly the same higher level vector to produce different vectors at the next level down when the neural net you're using is the same everywhere? So the idea is that the top down and bottom up neural nets will be shared between all locations. They'll be specific to a pair of levels, but they won't be specific to a location. So the net that's used in the rightmost three columns and the net that's used in the leftmost three columns is the same net, but it's taking as input that black vector, and it's producing either the red vector or the green vector. So how can it do that? Well, that's where an idea called neural fields comes in. It's a fairly straightforward idea, and I'll show you a simple example. Whoops. Yes. Suppose that we have just four pixels. I'm going to make locations really simple. Now, they're going to be individual pixels, and they have four intensities, and the intensities are given by the equation at the top of the slide there. And so this is a little piece of image that's coherent. That is, it's a linear intensity gradient. And because this is a sort of coherent piece of image, we might like to give all the pieces of this image, all the pixels, exactly the same code to indicate that they're part of this coherent piece. But of course, they've got different pixel intensities. And if we want to be able to reconstruct the pixel intensities from the code, it looks difficult, but it's no problem. We make the decoder, which is the top-down neural net, we make it take an extra argument, which is the location for which it's making the prediction. So once it gets this extra argument, it can make different predictions in different places. And that's the sort of fundamental insight of neural fields, which are now used very successfully in graphics for getting very good models of images. So we're going to use neural fields in a somewhat more complicated way. If you have to predict the parts of a face, remember the vector for the face contains the information about the coordinate transform between the face and the image. That is, the pose of the face is the relation between the face and the image. And each location, each column, knows where it is in image coordinates. So that means, given that vector for the face, that's the same in all face all locations occupied by the face, and given the particular column with its own particular location, you have the information available to compute where that column is in 3D within the frame of reference that you're using for the face. And so because you know where the column is relative to the face, you know which part of the face ought to be there. And so that's how the top-down neural network is able to construct different vectors in different places. But it's tricky. It needs a couple of hidden layers to do that. In the simulations we're using, we use three hidden layers at present. In the brain, between two levels, which correspond to different cortical areas, there's several synapses in each direction. So in the brain, there's these little loops between two cortical areas. There's an encoder, which is the bottom-up neural net, which takes a representation in one area and converts it to the representation in the higher level area. And then there's a decoder, which again has a few hidden layers, which converts back again. And so the architecture of neocortex actually looks like this. You've got these local loops for converting between representations in different brain areas, and the representations get progressively more complex. But that's all I'm going to say about the top down. It's able to predict different things in different places from exactly the same vector because it knows the location it's predicting for. The bottom up's more complicated. You get problems that you don't get in computer graphics. Bottom up, you might get ambiguous parts. So suppose you're interpreting a line drawing, you might see a circle. And you don't know whether the circle is going to be a left eye or a right eye or a front wheel or a back wheel. And you have two possible approaches now. The more standard approach is to say, well, we better disambiguate this part before we start trying to predict what hole it belongs to. We better do some kind of lateral interactions within a level to try to sort out what part it is. And so if you have something that might be a nose and something else that might be a mouth, you'd like them to support each other in their beliefs that they're a nose and a mouth if they have the right spatial relationship. But in order to see that, we need the nose to do something like put out a query saying, is there anything that might be a mouth that has the following pose? And it would take its own pose and multiply by the nose-to-mouth relationship. And now it would be able to ask, is there anything that might be a mouth that has that pose? And the mouth would be able to send messages to the nose saying, yeah, and I think you should have this pose. And it would have to take its pose and translate it back again through the inverse coordinate transform. And so that's quite complicated interactions. And there's n squared of them if you have n parts. An alternative way to do business, which is in some ways much simpler, allows you much simpler interactions within a level, is called a Huff transform. And what you do is you take each part and you force it to make a multimodal ambiguous prediction for the whole. So if I see a circle, depending on in some limited domain, it has to say, the whole might be a face with this pose because I'm the left eye, or it might be a face with that pose because I'm the right eye, or it might be a car with this pose because I'm the front wheel, or it might be a car with that pose because I'm the back wheel. So there's, you know, when I see a circle, there's four possible combinations of object identity and pose. And it has to be able to represent a probability distribution across all those possible modes, all those possible combinations of identity and pose. If you don't know about capsules, ignore that comment. Now, that's a difficult thing to do. But if the bottom-up neural net can do that, it can take an ambiguous part and it can make a multimodal prediction. Then at the next level up, you can just use averaging or adding. You don't need complicated interactions. And the reason is, if your multimodal prediction for what's happening at the next level up in your own column is represented by basis functions in a log probability space over the space of combinations of identities and poses, then when you combine log probability distributions, you simply add them up. They're negative energies. And if you've got two different sources of information, you want to get the log probability distributions and just add them up. So the idea here is a sort of daring idea. It's to say, suppose that within a column, we can predict complicated unnormalized log probability distributions the next level up. Then all we need to get parts to interact in order to resolve those ambiguities is just do averaging in the next level up. This is an example of a mathematical theorem due to Kolmogorov and Arnold, I think, called the superposition theorem, which says that if you want things to interact, all you have to do is transform the things right and then use addition. The only form of interaction you ever need between things is addition if you transform them right first. Now, for some things, the transformations are horrendous, but for other things, you're very used to it. So, for example, if you want to multiply two numbers, I can do that just by adding things up. As long as I start by taking their logs, then I add them up, and then I anti-log at the end. And that's generic. The functions you need to use can be quite complicated, but it's generic that you can always just use addition for combining things if you transform the things right first and then transform them back right afterwards. And that's what GLOM's relying on. It's saying, if we can get this bottom-up neural net to give us the multimodal predictions that contain all the ambiguities that the part can't resolve, then we can resolve them at the next level up. So in order to do that, we need to ask, what does each of the neurons in the embedding vector for the object do? So each neuron is going to represent a distribution, a log probability distribution, over the space of possible poses and possible identities. The embedding itself will have many more dimensions than that space. The embedding might have thousands of dimensions. That space might be much lower dimensional because the object identities are going to be described in a distributed way, not a one of n code, but a distributed vector even for the identity. Now, each neuron in the embedding for the object is a basis function in that log probability space. And the activity of a neuron is the scale on that basis function. It's a multiplier of its probabilities. It's an exponent if you think of probabilities. It's just a multiplier if you think of log probabilities. And so if you ask what the whole vector represents, it's all these basis functions representing scales on these rather vague distributions, log probability distributions. But when you add them all together, you'll get a sharper probability distribution or log probability distribution. But it can still have multiple modes because we need that. We need to be able to represent ambiguity in that space. And they're all talking about a single object because you're talking about the object that's currently occupying this location in the image. You can't use this kind of representation if you're trying to talk about several things at once. Then you have to use something like coarse coding, which is much less efficient. Here, if you're only talking about one thing at a time, namely the object occupying this location, I may not know what it is, but I can use these very distributed basis functions, much like Fourier functions, in order to represent it fairly accurately, even if it's a multimodal distribution. That's the most complicated thing of this talk. I should say, this is a very complicated talk, particularly if you're not in this area. There's a paper on archive that I'll mention at the end that contains everything I've said. So think of this as just an attempt to get you to read the paper. So here's a little demonstration that this idea can work. We take images composed of 10 ellipses, and these contain faces or sheep, and they can be in any orientation, size, and scale within limits for the scale and position. And we feed them into a simplified version of the GLOM system. And after it's settled down, what we do is we take the final object level embeddings, and using the top-down neural net from the object level embeddings, we predict what the ellipses should be, and then we draw those ellipses. And so if it works, it should get two object level embeddings, which are almost identical for the locations occupied by the five ellipses that make one object. And from those object level embeddings, we should be able to reconstruct the ellipses. And as you can see, we can do that almost exactly. So we can get it to work in a simple case. The actual system looks like this. It doesn't actually have pixels as input or words as output. We have an ellipse symbol, which is just six linear neurons that represent the degrees of freedom of the ellipse. You can ask me later about the issue that an ellipse only has 5 degrees of freedom. We have hundreds of basis functions, between 300 and 1,000 for representing the embedding of the ellipse, and hundreds between 300 and 1,000 for the object. Initially, because you just see the ellipse, you have no clue or very little clue what kind of part it is. So that ellipse embedding needs to be highly ambiguous about which part it might be. As the network settles down, the ellipse embedding can get much less ambiguous. The ellipse, if it's a mouse, the ellipse embedding can gradually change and say, hey, I'm a mouse. So I can make a much sharper prediction for what the object should be. It should be a face. And I can tell you exactly the pose of the face. So what's happening is initially these things will be very vague. They'll be highly multimodal distributions. They're interacting via these bottom-up and top-down neural nets, but the averaging with similar things going on at nearby locations is going to be removing ambiguities as it settles down. And you get a runaway process where when the object starts getting an idea what it should be, it can start telling the parts what they should be. And if all that fits together, they very quickly converge on a fairly sharp opinion about what should be there. I'm almost at the end. A system like this can be trained in many ways. For this little demo, we trained it supervised. That is, we knew what the object symbols ought to be, and we trained the neural net so when it settled down, at the final time step, it would be able to reconstruct the ellipses from the ellipse embeddings, and also it would be able to reconstruct the objects from the object embeddings. And so it's supervised training. We were just interested in, can you represent these multimodal distributions and use attention-weighted averaging to disambiguate things within a level? And the answer is, yes, you can in this case. You could train it without any supervision signal, that is, without knowing the object level embedding, just by you give it 10 ellipses, but actually you only give it 9 of them, and you ask it at the final time step to fill in all 10. And in order to do that, it has to learn about shapes, right? That's how a language model called BERT is trained. And BERT produces very good embeddings for words and is able to generate very plausible looking stories. That would be one way to train it. But there's one thing missing from that training, I think it's also missing from BERT, which is just training it to produce the right ellipses at the end, even if some of them are missing at the beginning, isn't explicitly encouraging it to produce islands of almost identical vectors. And so we need to add one more thing to the training, which is contrastive learning. That's how we were doing unsupervised training for image patches before. So what you do is you say that the top-down neural net's making a prediction for what should be happening at level L. And so is the bottom-up neural net. What we actually put at level L at the next time step is the average of the top-down prediction, the bottom-up prediction, and the attention-weighted average of what's going on in nearby locations. So I call that the consensus opinion. So now we have an extra signal for training the top-down neural net. The signal says, try and make your prediction agree with the consensus. That's what you normally do when you fit a statistical model to data. You try and make the prior of your model agree with the posterior. Okay. So that will train the top-down neural net and the bottom-up neural net, and it'll train them to produce predictions that are more like the predictions coming from neighboring columns because of this attention-weighted averaging. So what's really happening is you're training these nets so that they will agree better with things that are already similar, and that will give you much better islands. In fact, in a real brain, you don't have sharing of weights. You can't copy the synapses. So the question is, how do you get something like a convolutional net in a real brain? Because we know that using the same knowledge for different locations is statistically very efficient because it's in the nature of vision for the information in the distribution to be the same at different locations. And so you'd like to apply the same knowledge, even though in any particular image you have different things in different locations. How do you share weights in a brain? Well, you don't. You share knowledge. And the way you share knowledge is by a technique called co-distillation. I don't have time to explain, but basically the top-down and bottom-up neural nets in one column are determining the representation in that column. That column, via attention-weighted averaging, is providing a target for neighboring columns. And this is happening between all the columns. And so what happens is the columns will tend to converge on nets that agree. They won't necessarily have the same weights in them, but they'll be computing pretty much the same function. And I think that's how the brain gets this statistical efficiency of having the same knowledge in different locations by doing this averaging of predictions with things you already agree with and relying on the fact that the real world contains spatial coherence. And it's the spatial coherence in the real world that allows you to sort of transport the knowledge over locations. Got two more slides, I think. It seems wasteful to replicate this object level vector everywhere, particularly if you're raised with a standard computer with random access memory, where you don't want lots of copies of a thing, you want one copy and then you refer to that copy. But it's not wasteful during the settling. If you think of this icing model settling down before it knows where the islands are, it's very good to have these separate neurons for representing separate opinions about what the vectors are in different locations. They may all be copies of each other at the end, but as it's settling down, they're not. And a location needs to do things like hedge its bets about whether it goes with these locations or whether it goes with those locations. And so it needs its own vector where it can sort of average those two to hedge its bets. What's going on as you form these islands? It looks like I'm clustering, but it's not exactly like clustering. So in clustering, what you do is you have some data and you're looking for clusters in that data, but the data's fixed, right? So I give you some data points and I say, where are the clusters? You're not allowed to move the data points around to make nicer clusters. That's cheating. You have to find the clusters in the data. But here, in all the levels of this icing model, as the thing's settling down, all of these levels are changing at the same time. That is, the external field within a column provided by the level above and the level below for a particular level, those external fields are themselves evolving. And so what you're really trying to do is create these islands, create clusters, and that's very different from discovering clusters in fixed data. It's a different kind of an algorithm, and I think it should work better, but we won't know until we've got a big version of this working. Finally, another advantage of this replication is that as you go up to higher levels, you get bigger and bigger islands. And now if you have long range but sparse connectivity, a location might be able to see a location some distance away, but not other nearer locations. But that's fine if it's at a high level, because there's a lot of replication of vectors. So you just need to sample one other vector within the island to see what the vector is. You don't have to sample all of them. So we can afford to have sparseness where we have big islands. And that's another reason why it's not a waste of time to be replicating these vectors. So in summary, I combine three important advances that have happened over the last 5 years or so in neural networks into a system called GLOM. The first of them is a simplified version of transformers. For those of you who know about transformers, it's a version where the embedding and the key and the query and the value are all the same vector. So all the transformer is doing is attention weighted averaging. There's contrastive unsupervised learning of representations. That's when you're getting these predictions to all agree. And then there's neural fields. That's when you're using the location you're making the prediction for to make different predictions for different locations. And I combined all these to solve the problem of how you might represent a parse tree, which is dynamic, in a neural net, which is static. So how do you represent the parse tree without allocating neurons to nodes? And I am done. And there's the archive paper that has everything I said in this talk and more besides. It even has a section on the relationship to icing models. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, feel free to unmute to thank Jeff for that talk. And can I, now I see Lee has had a question for a long time, but in keeping with tradition, Lee, before I go to you, let me just take a moment to ask if there are any questions from students.
Yeah, I have a question.
Go for it.
Hang on just a sec while I put my earphones in because I can hear better.
Yeah, can I ask now?
Yes.
Yeah, so you probably already mentioned this, but I guess I missed it. So you mentioned that there's multiple ways of training such a model, and I wanted to ask if all the ways are deterministic, like will they all give the same result? And in the light of having so many different ways of training the model, can we, without doing an experiment, like without actually training, can we tell which way would be the optimal way in terms of time taken to be trained or performance, I guess?
Yeah. So with neural nets, even if you use the same way, if you use it twice, you won't get the same result because you break symmetries by random initialization. So you get different results each time. The results are qualitatively similar, but even the same way of training will give you different results. And certainly the different ways of training will tend to give you different results, and some will be much better than others. If you have the labeled data available, That is, if you were dealing with images generated by computer graphics and you happen to know what the underlying object poses were, you'd be crazy not to use that if what you wanted was rapid training. But for understanding the brain, we don't have that stuff available, right? Nobody injects the truth into the high levels of the cortex. Occasionally, someone will inject a verbal label. But basically, the unsupervised methods that don't use the feedback from the object level embeddings, that just try to fill in missing parts of images, plus using this contrastive unsupervised learning to get islands of agreement, that's what you're going to have to use in a brain. So that's what I think of as the best method, because that's what the brain might use. But the most efficient method is to give it labeled examples, like we did in the toy example with the ellipses.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other student questions? If not, could Lee, are you, do you have a question?
Sure, thank you. That was really, really interesting. I have a question about data. If you're trying to reproduce biology, can you make any use of the old idea that in every creature, the embryology recapitulates the history of the creature? And can you find, if you are positing that there are different systems that fit together in the mature creature, is it possible you can find evidence for that in the, does anybody do microembryology of the visual systems of?
Okay, this is the point at which you discover my knowledge of biology is rather limited. I completely agree with you about the idea that the embryology recapitulates the evolutionary history. So you'd be tempted to look back. Now, unfortunately, cortex is soft, and I don't think it's preserved very well. It'd be lovely to look back and see how it changed when animals became more visual, for example. But you can do it with current animals. Mm-hmm. If you look at cortex, the visual cortex is somewhat special. V1 looks different from other bits of cortex. It's the most obviously different bit of cortex. But the other parts of the visual system look pretty much the same as the rest of the cortex. That is, a neuroanatomist will tell you they're quite different because that's their stock in trade to tell the difference. Mm. But to first order, all the neocortex looks the same. And it looks like there's something called a canonical microcircuit, which is this little autoencoder loop I talked about, which is the encoder and the decoder. And those are local. So the visual system is full of these maps. So neurons are dedicated to a particular region of the image, and you get these local autoencoder circuits. That's what it looks like to me. Nobody knows how they get their gradients for training them, but I haven't really answered your question. Because I don't know the answer to whether you can use this embryological development to, yeah.
Well, it's thank you. Thank you. Sounds like a good idea.
Rob, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Well, first of all, that was a really interesting talk. It's going to take some time to absorb it all. I wanted to ask a question about sort of where you start in terms of, you know, your motivation to understand how human cognition works. And I'm just wondering to what extent that this particular picture of Glom sort of provides new opportunity, if there's sort of specific opportunities for sort of testing the idea that this is really how human cognition works. And in particular, it strikes me that a lot of the ideas you described, you know, that the visual cognition is just one example, you know, the notion of attention would apply for lots of other types of cognition, and the whole idea of needing to distinguish parts and wholes would apply as well. And so I'm kind of curious whether perhaps sort of the slight differences we see in the nature of attention and part-whole relationships and even different types of cognitions, you know, would that maybe even be a tool for trying to determine whether Glom is really a good description of the human cognition system?
Yes, it might be, but I've always been kind of slightly wary of looking at small differences between either between people or between different things people do. I think they're kind of second order when you don't really understand how the thing works at all. I think we're still at the stage.
Sorry, just to clarify, I meant differences between, for example, the auditory system and the visual system. For example, if the nature of attention in your auditory system and the your ability to recognize part-whole relationships in your auditory system were somehow different from then in your visual system, okay, you might expect to see under the hypothesis of Glom certain kinds of correlations in the nature of attention and in the nature of, you know, the part-whole hierarchy. Now, that's the sort of idea I had in mind.
Yeah, okay, that's much more reasonable, right? Sorry, I misunderstood. We do know some things. We know that, for example, if you take a ferret, ferrets are born very young, which sounds odd, but they're born basically as embryos. And so you can do experiments on very immature brains and you rewire a ferret. So the visual input goes to auditory cortex and no auditory input goes to auditory cortex. And it will then develop visual receptive fields in auditory cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, people managed to show that it can actually use those visual fields, not just to drive microelectrodes, but actually to drive behavior. So it can have visually based behavior. Now, it's not clear how good that behavior is. It's not clear, for example, whether it can do shape recognition. It's one argument that cortex is very sort of pluripotent. But yeah, it would be interesting to see if, for example, the lateral interactions within a level, the longer range lateral interactions within a level are different in visual and auditory cortex and to relate that to the different needs. And I just don't know the answer.
Thanks. Let me ask you the more general version, if I may, Latham. I don't know if there's a long list of people.
Go ahead. Not that I can see. Go for it.
Okay. Do you have specific ideas for how you might test the hypothesis that it's really a Glom-like system that's going on in human cognition?
Yes. So at this point, I've kind of injected all my ideas that I've got from other fields about how vision might be working into the model. And so at this point, it's really up to, does this model, can I make this model work now? It doesn't actually work yet. And either it's going to work well or it's not going to work well. And my experience with models is that some of them want to work and some of them don't want to work. My sort of paradigm for this is controlled nuclear fusion. That clearly doesn't want to work. Whatever you do, the plasma tries to escape. And you try and contain it and it tries to escape. And it's not really cooperating with you. Whereas something like backpropagation, where you just follow the gradients to learn parameters, that wants to work. Even if you make a mistake in your equations for computing the gradient, it still works, as long as you don't get a minus sign in there. And so there's some ideas that want to work and some ideas that don't. And variational learning in neural nets wants to work because you make approximations, you get a learning signal that's incorrect, but due to the approximations, but the incorrectness in the learning signal tries to correct the model so it fits the approximations better. So there's things that want to work and things that don't. And the question is, does Glom want to work? That's how I think of it. And the next thing to do is spend the next 6 months figuring out whether Glom will work or not.
Okay, thanks.
Lee, go ahead.
Well, just a quick question. Is there a principle that the brain wants to resolve ambiguity?
I think there is, yes. So if you take, certainly in visual perception, if you're doing visual perception, think of the vases and faces. Mm-hmm. After you've seen it both ways, you know there's two ways of seeing that, but you don't see them both at once.
Yeah.
You come up with a unique interpretation, which may flip like the Necker cube, but you don't see both at once. And you certainly don't see with the Necker cube, you realize now there's a whole range of shapes, most of which don't contain right angles, which are compatible with the image. And you don't see that whole range. You pick something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good way to do business for vision because we're in a situation where there's enough information in the sensory data to nearly always come up with the correct interpretation. And so mm-hmm. I think our visual system's committed to coming up with, and I think it does sampling, but it's doing sampling where you nearly always get the correct sample and just occasionally you get a bad one. And vision is like that. When I was a graduate student, I started keeping notes of how often my perception went wrong. And initially you think your visual perception is pretty good, but if you become intently aware of whenever it goes wrong every few seconds, and then you notice it's gone wrong. And it all happens so fast that unless you're concentrating on it, you don't notice these slight mistakes you're making. But basically you get it right in vision. And so it doesn't need to maintain the ambiguity.
Yes, thank you. I see animals.
Oh, sorry, I've got one more example. I just realized this is very relevant. So GLOM is set up, you'll notice the horizontal axis was time. So this network is settling down over time. Mm-hmm. It's designed so it can handle video. So now with video, you could think of video either as a frame comes in, I analyze the hell out of that frame. The next frame comes in, I analyze the hell out of that frame, and I stick these analyses together in a time series. And that's the wrong way to think of video. The right way to think of video is I've got an extra dimension to my data, which is time, and my neuron's going to have receptive fields that are tuned in time as well as in space. Mm-hmm. And with GLOM, what's going to happen is you've got these iterations. When I show you a static image, it's really a very boring video. It's a video where the same frame keeps coming in. Mm-hmm. And GLOM now has time to settle down. It has time to resolve the ambiguities. And it's using those iterations. But if the video is changing, then those same iterations that we use for settling for a static image, you're going to have to be used for tracking in the changing image, for staying up to date with the data. And they're not available for settling on a good interpretation of what's happening in one frame. So now try the following experiment. Take a very irregularly shaped potato and throw it up in the air so that it's rotating at about one revolution per second. And you simply cannot see the shape of it. You look at it. When it's static, you can see the shape. When it's up in the air, I mean, you know it's sort of roughly convex and you know roughly how big it is, but the shape, you've no idea. So I think that's an example where you haven't given it time to settle on an interpretation and it's got this very vague interpretation of the shape.
Beautiful, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Maybe I'll just insert one here. At the beginning of the talk, I think you mentioned that an ordinary neural net can be sort of fooled by small changes to the input if done adversarially, and you'd like to design something that avoids that problem.
Yep.
Now, and then on the other hand, human cognition is also susceptible to, you know, we're also susceptible to optical illusions.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's related to the robustness against the first problem, or are those sort of two in other words, as you become more robust to the first problem, do you run into the second problem, or
my guess is they're separate things, and that's one of the sources of information. You'd like GLOM to suffer from similar illusions if you want it as a model of the brain, and there's one illusion it suffers from big time that partly motivated GLOM, which is, it's called crowding. So let's suppose that GLOM was right and that for each little patch of image, you had this multi-level representation that assumed there was one thing there. So now what happens if I put two things in a patch where I assume there's one thing? I'm not going to be able to deal with it. I might see it as a sort of more complicated kind of thing, this pair, but it's really going to screw me up. And so if I take letters, and I put them in the paraphobia, slightly off to one side, and I make them fairly big. If they're well spaced, I can read them just fine. But if I put them close together, they completely confuse each other. And that's because I think they're interfering. They're getting in each other's patches. And you'll also notice that with type, everybody thinks that if you make the type bigger, you'll make it easier to read. But actually, if you have type and you make it bigger and the letters are crowded together, it gets harder to read. The way you make it easier to read is make the letters smaller so they're further apart, up to a certain limit. So having things well separated is something GLOM would really like, because you're not going to get confused within a column. And that's a very strong effect in human perception called crowding.
Okay, thank you. So let's see, are there any final questions? Any last questions? If not, let's thank Jeffrey one more time for an extremely stimulating talk.
Thank you.